From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. One of the most frustrating aspects of the coronavirus pandemic is that our understanding of it has been evolving, and it's been hard for the public to keep up with advice on how to protect themselves and their families. And so today on The Exchange, we answer your questions as much as possible. We're talking with state epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan and with deputy state epidemiologist Dr. Elizabeth Talbot. Also helping us out today will be my colleague Jason Moon. He's NHPR's health reporter. And Exchange listeners, as always, we welcome your questions. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can give us a call, 1-800-864-77, 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Chan, I'd like to start with you, please. What are the latest numbers that you have that tell us about the spread of COVID-19 in New Hampshire?
So the pandemic is continuing globally. You know, we're worldwide, we're up to almost 2.5 million cases and over 780,000 cases in the United States. In New Hampshire, we're at 1,447 cases of COVID-19, people that have been confirmed with COVID-19 infection. What we're seeing in the numbers is still consistent with what we've talked about the last week. The overall number of new cases every day that's being reported to us is stabilizing or plateauing, so to speak. The number of daily hospitalizations, people that are hospitalized on a daily basis for COVID-19, has been relatively stable the last couple of weeks. Our healthcare system has not reached what we call surge capacity. And I think at this point we're waiting and watching for the numbers to decline. That doesn't mean we're sitting around. That means we're continuing our public health investigations, isolating people, putting people who have been in close contact with someone with COVID-19 on quarantine, trying to ramp up testing in our state so we can be in a better position for when we start to reopen things around the state. But right now it's important for people to continue with their social distancing measures, because that's how we're going to get these numbers to go back down.
Well, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago, Dr. Chan, in early April. This week, and I remember you saying this week was predicted to be the peak week for infections in New Hampshire. Do you think that will still be the case, given what you just told about the way the numbers are tracking?
Yeah, I think it very much depends on how well and how strictly we adhere to the social distancing. Right, we've seen a plateau, so it certainly could be, a peak that we're hitting here in the state. But there's still widespread transmission of COVID-19 going on in the community. And so, if we were to open things back up, suddenly, rapidly, we would be at high risk for seeing the numbers go back up. And I think that's the concern, not only in New Hampshire but around the United States, and that's why there's this ongoing discussion about how we can gradually and incrementally look to open things in the state, closely following the numbers, monitoring, transmission of COVID-19 so we can prevent any sort of rebound in terms of the numbers.
Well, and again, you've talked about the importance of social distancing and how we are seeing evidence that it's working. How concerned are you, Dr. Chan, that this week and next, many school districts have decided to go ahead with April break? So kids will be out. The weather is nice. Speaking of someone who has teenagers, it's going to be hard to keep those kids indoors or away from each other.
Yeah, I think that's one of the that's one of the challenges with social distancing, staying at home, remote learning. We have tried to build social distancing into our daily lives. And the success of that is going to depend on people being willing and complying with, staying at home as much as possible. Understandably, it is important for people to be out and exercising and being active. We don't want people to be entirely isolated at home. That has, long-term mental and emotional tolls on people. So we encourage people to be outside, walking, running, but it's important when they are outside to maintain a safe distance of at least 6 feet from other people, that's social distancing, and to try to stay home as much as possible and avoid unnecessary trips out. But we understand that, the weather is getting nicer and people, can and should be outside, but they need to
Well, and Dr. Talbot, those numbers that Dr. Chan gave us at the beginning of the show, how useful are these numbers for the public, given that the vast majority of Granite Staters are not being tested?
It's a great point. You're expressing our own frustration and awareness that we have not tested everyone we want to test, right? So there have been challenges at every step of the way toward getting a patient tested, you know, whether they don't have a primary care doc, whether their doc's not willing to test, whether their doc has the supplies, whether there's a courier to take it the sample where it needs to go, et cetera. So we are looking and working to increase testing so that everybody who needs it can get it done.
We got so many questions, as you can imagine, Dr. Talbot, from our listeners about testing. Here are two, and these came from our survey at nhpr.org, where listeners have been sharing their stories and their questions. Anne from Manchester wrote us, "Why can't we start testing everyone on a regular basis?" Anne says, "This is done in other countries, but we don't seem to be able to measure up in this country or in this state. There needs to be mass testing." And Elizabeth from Goffstown with a similar comment. She says, "What is the basic problem with leading to our inability to get adequate testing in place?" And Dr. Talbot, to Elizabeth's point, what is our basic problem with this?
In the beginning, we didn't have the test kits. So the actual test that's used in the laboratory was a limitation that lasted way longer than we expected. This was a problem with the CDC test that we thought would come straight away, and then it was delayed, and when it came, it had a dysfunction to it. So that was the first problem. Then there was the issue of, do we have enough swabs to actually take the sample? That seems like such a trivial part of things, right? Like, why not use a Q-tip or whatever? And
right.
It's just much more complicated than that, because the technology that's used to analyze the specimen is very sensitive to the components of that swab. So it has to be just right. And we continue to have issues with settings that are not really set up or equipped with the right personal protective equipment for their healthcare workers to take that specimen. So again, we could go on and on, but I think the message is that we're going to get there. It's been a very slow, unexpectedly slow process. And Anne and Elizabeth are quite right that we are below some other countries, but I would say a lot of other countries have had these troubles too.
Well, and how far did that set us back, Dr. Talbot? We've heard from listeners who didn't feel well at the end of February, the end of March. They tried to get tested. Their doctor said, "Have you been in China? Have you been in Italy?" And when people said no, they said, "Okay, you probably just have the flu." I'm just wondering how much this set us back.
It's a question that is going to be answered, I think, that we'll understand more about how lack of testing has allowed this virus to transmit. But I would offer that if you were told by a doc that, "No, we're not going to test you. We don't have equipment. We don't think you're in the right group," whatever, that you still should have stayed home, right? I mean, so you still should have isolated. And so whether you had the test or not, we're hoping that that you adhere to the recommended self-isolation to prevent ongoing transmission. So that's something that's put in place as a redundancy to the ability to test and give a specific imperative to stay home.
Well, and I want to throw it now to my colleague Jason Moon for a lot more questions on testing. So Jason, go ahead.
Thanks, Laura. Dr. Chan, we've been aware of some of these testing challenges for a while, the issues with the CDC kits, the lack of testing supplies, reagents, the swabs, so forth. But those problems aren't unique to New Hampshire, and yet we have a lower testing rate than any of our neighbors. In fact, any other state in New England, New Hampshire is tested at proportional to our population, fewer people than any other state in New England. What do you think accounts for that, and how much of a concern is that for you as an epidemiologist?
Yeah, so I think there's several questions in there. I think those are important questions. And I think it's important to it's hard to compare New Hampshire to a state like Massachusetts or New York, so who have more people and more, you know, healthcare resources, so to speak. But understanding your question, you know, we're also, you know, New Hampshire is being compared to Vermont and Maine and other places. And so, as Dr. Talbot mentioned, we are absolutely aware of the need for increasing our testing capacity, and we're actively working towards that. I think testing is important for a number of reasons. Testing is important because it can help inform the care of an individual. If we were able to go out and test everybody with, you know, symptoms, you know, testing would give us a more accurate number to know how widely COVID-19 is being transmitted. But one of the key roles for testing is its use in containing the spread of COVID-19. And what is going to stop or slow the outbreak where we are now is, I believe, primarily going to be the social distancing measures that are in place. Right. So we believe COVID-19 is widespread in our communities. We, and I don't think any state has the capacity to go out and test everybody that we believe might have cold symptoms or symptoms, even mild symptoms of COVID-19. And so that's the purpose of the social distancing measures that have been put into place, is to stop transmission between people, whether someone is tested or not, as Dr. Talbot mentioned. Testing becomes critically more important as we see the numbers in our communities decline, as we see community transmission decline, and as we move from more of a community mitigation social distancing stance to wanting to try and contain this virus more so that we can open things back up in our communities. And that is something that we, and I know others in the state, are actively working towards so that we can dramatically ramp up testing. That is our goal, and that will be important, especially for when we begin to open things back up. But we are making efforts right now to increase testing. We have updated our guidance to healthcare providers just in the last week, advising, you know, increased populations of people to test. So we're working towards it. There are limitations we're trying to work through, and so I think people can expect to see increased testing and even increased numbers of people diagnosed with COVID-19 in the coming days as we work to test more.
Well, and just to follow up on that, and maybe I'll turn it to you, Dr. Talbot, what are the factors that have gotten us to the point where we are now, where Vermont, for instance, is testing at twice the rate as New Hampshire, Rhode Island is testing at more than three times the rate? Is it a lack of communication or awareness among providers about the correct protocols for who should get tested? Is it a particular shortage of testing supplies that has somehow only impacted New Hampshire? I'm just thinking a lot of listeners will be confused to hear that they're testing at twice the rate in neighboring Vermont. What is behind that?
I'm frankly not aware of the supply chain in Vermont or Maine, but I do know that we have very intentionally laser focused on the vulnerable populations in our state. We want the limited testing to go to those people who need it most. So those are those who are in an institution, such as a long-term care facility, a residential behavioral health, those settings where elderly are cared for, or those who have complex medical problems. So we, I think, have been on very solid footing to direct our attention to those populations who are the most likely to need hospitalization, supportive care, and even some of the novel treatments that are becoming available.
And I understand that today that many of the state's long-term care workers are being tested across the state. So that's an example of that targeted testing you're talking about. I did want to ask about another potential opportunity for targeted testing. We saw that as of last Thursday, there were 426 first responders across the state quarantined because of possible exposure to the coronavirus. Are there any plans in the works to offer rapid testing for first responders so that they don't have to be quarantined for a couple of weeks, you know, unnecessarily if they don't have the virus? And as a quick follow to that, how many days after a potential exposure does a test become effective? If an ambulance worker comes into contact with someone on a Thursday who tests positive, will they, you know, how long do you have to wait before you test that ambulance worker?
So I'm not sure if that question was directed at Dr. Talbot or myself, but maybe I'll take a first go at it. It's important to, I think, differentiate between testing people that are symptomatic, people with symptoms, and people that are asymptomatic. Testing someone who has been exposed to the virus and is not having symptoms is only helpful if that test is positive, right? If that test is negative, it doesn't mean that that person isn't going to go on to develop infection or might have just been exposed and the test is not sensitive enough yet to pick up the virus because it hasn't had enough time to reproduce and replicate in a person. So a test in an asymptomatic person, someone without symptoms, is only helpful if that test is positive. So, you know, anybody, whether it's a first responder, a healthcare worker, someone in the community, you know, a household member, if they have been exposed to someone with COVID-19, they are asked to quarantine regardless of whether they're tested or not. Even if they were tested and test negative, if they were exposed to someone with COVID-19, they should still be under quarantine. Now, there are exceptions for people that are considered essential workers. That includes healthcare providers, you know, EMS workers, that if someone was exposed, they can be allowed back to work under certain precautions. Involving, you know, symptom and temperature monitoring every day. The person has to wear a mask in case they, and, you know, if they develop symptoms, needs to be sent home right away. So testing people that are asymptomatic does not necessarily change what they are asked to do. And in this day and age where we know that COVID-19 is spreading widely across the United States, then people can be spreading the virus even before they have symptoms. Everybody needs to be taking precautions and, you know, practicing social distancing, staying at home as much as possible. For people that are healthcare workers or EMS workers, the recommendation now is that, you know, people, especially if they're in a healthcare facility, should be wearing a mask to help mitigate this spread of the virus in the event that they might be spreading it asymptomatically.
So you're saying then that if we were to test those 426 emergency responders and they all tested negative, it wouldn't necessarily mean that the ones who were quarantined would immediately be free to move back into the community as normal?
Correct. They would still be asked to operate under the same restrictions that they were initially, even if they tested negative.
We've got a lot more questions about testing from our listeners and a lot of questions about immunity. Also just concerns about daily health and safety practices, masks, where and how to wear them, and so on. We will talk about those after a short break. Keep your questions coming in. You can send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the state's top medical officials address your questions and concerns about the coronavirus. You can send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with state epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan and deputy state epidemiologist Dr. Elizabeth Talbot. Also asking questions today is NHPR health reporter Jason Moon. And all of you, we have received so many questions from our listeners about testing, about immunity. We will take as many as possible. For example, right now, let's talk to Bob in Concord. He's calling in. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Morning. My question is for both doctors, I think, and that is in the context of Vermont being what appears to be about 10 days past peak and New Hampshire looking like there's really two New Hampshires. There's the very infected part in the southeast corner, and then there's the rest of New Hampshire. When would you propose implementing a tracing quarantine, and why not create a two-pronged strategy of dealing with the southeast corner differently and then the rest of New Hampshire, which looks like they've got it under control?
Wow, Bob, great question, and raises a lot of issues that are right at the forefront right now, when people can start to emerge and the role of contact tracing in that. And Dr. Talbot, first of all, just explain to our listeners briefly what contact tracing is. That's a big issue now.
Sure, I'm happy to. It's something that we've been engaged in since day one. So this has been a major effort for us to identify persons who first test positive or are those with compatible symptoms such that we believe they have disease, whether they've tested positive or not. And there we ask them where they've been, who they've been in contact with in a significant way. And then those people are asked to be on quarantine to prevent ongoing transmission in the event that they should come down with disease. So this is what we do. This is our active strategy, and we're going to continue to ramp it up. Because the example we have from other jurisdictions, from other countries, from other states, is that that's the key to prevent ongoing transmission and propagation of the epidemic. Again, you've heard, this is a terrible virus for the fact that it can transmit even before a person has symptoms. And that's why we've put so much effort into, first of all, that contact tracing and subsequent quarantine, and second, the request that everyone wear a cloth mask when they're out in public, because that's what we call source control, preventing a person who doesn't even know that they're going to come down with disease and illness in 48 hours from contaminating the environment or inadvertently spreading it to those people that they are wandering within 6 feet.
Well, and you mentioned masks, and we've got a lot of questions about masks. For example, from Ben, who writes, if we've known that this is primarily a respiratory transmitted virus, why has the administration been so slow to adopt and enforce face masks for all civilians and workers? And Dr. Chan, I'll throw that to you.
So I'm not sure what authority Ben is referring to, whether the federal authorities or state authorities. I think part of the difficulty with any new pathogen is learning about it and learning how it transmits and how easily it transmits. And I think it's only in the last, several weeks, months or so that we've really realized the extent that this virus can be spread and transmitted before someone develops symptoms. And that has, the needing to learn about this virus in real time has made it difficult, I think, to come up with strategies to control it. But given what we know now, people who are out in public should be wearing cloth face coverings. Given how easily this virus can transmit, given the fact that it can be transmitted, days before someone develops symptoms, a cloth face covering is a great idea if people are going to be out in public places to prevent that person from wearing the cloth face covering from potentially giving it to other people unknowingly.
Well, I got a question from John in Amherst, who writes, I read that a face mask should be disinfected after each use. I also read that the longevity of coronavirus is up to 3 days. Does it therefore, John asks, suffice to let a mask sit for 4+ days between usage? John says, I go out to shop for groceries about once every 8 to 10 days, which is when I need my mask. And John, I'm so glad you wrote, because I think, Dr. Chan, a lot of listeners have this. Okay, I'll wear a mask when I go to the grocery store or the drugstore. It may not be perfect, but I'll wear it. And then you get back. I myself have had this question. What am I supposed to do with it when I get back, Dr. Chan?
Yeah, and again, we're talking about cloth-based coverings, so these should be washable. Right. So certainly the I believe the person who asked the question was John. Certainly John is right that, the longer you let something sit, the less likely, if there are fomites, infectious particles of the virus on there, the less likely those particles of virus are going to survive. But, if someone's only going out to the grocery store once a week, hopefully people are also routinely doing their laundry. Just throw the cloth face covering in the washing machine. That's how cloth face masks or cloth face coverings should be managed. Ideally, they should be washed. They should be used daily and washed, in between use every day. Understanding that not everybody does laundry every day, but if someone has multiple coverings. They can, you know, alternate between them. But the general recommendation is to clean the cloth face coverings, the cloth face masks, by using just a washing machine.
And I have tried to watch most of the briefings from the governor and top state officials. You know, I haven't caught all of them, but the last one I watched, Dr. Chan, people didn't have masks on. The governor, you, head of HHS. When are you guys going to start wearing masks?
Yeah, great question. Maybe we should. You know, I think that's a valid question. And I think that there are several things that go into transmitting the virus. You know, duration of time someone is in contact. You know, distance between people. And so when we hold these press meetings, there is an attempt to minimize close contact between people. And so if you'll notice at the meeting, we maintain at least 6 feet between people. And that should go a long ways to minimizing any transmission between people. But, you know, the other thing is that it's awfully difficult to talk sometimes through a face cloth covering, you know, your nose and mouth. But, you know, point taken, you know, is something maybe we need to discuss more.
Well, let's take another call. This is Sheila in Putney. And Sheila, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling today.
Can you hear me?
I sure can, Sheila. Go ahead.
Great. My question is about immunity. I know two people who were never tested, but they are quite sure that they had COVID. They had all the symptoms. But they're recovered. They've been quarantined for a month and a half. And I heard on the radio the other day that it is possible that you can recover, you can have the antibodies in your system and still be a carrier, still be contagious. Can you comment on that, please? I've heard that plus something opposite to that.
Sheila, I'm so glad that you called, and I want to let you know that another listener also had the exact same question. If you've had COVID-19, Ellen from Sullivan wrote, and you're recovered, are you immune? And Ellen and Sullivan also wanted to know, if I've had the virus, if I'm immune, can I still give it to other people? So thank you, Sheila, for calling. And Dr. Talbot, can you take that one, please?
I can try. We're, again, watching data emerge from settings where they're ahead of us, you know, so in some of the Asian countries that have experienced the epidemic earlier, there is the phenomenon where somebody even tests positive, and if you serially test them with the PCR, the routine test that's used here, you can see that the virus is detectable even out to 20 days, but it's bits and pieces. It's not sure that material is detected as something that could infect others. That's not been shown yet. We also have the phenomenon where somebody is confirmed with disease and they're tested serially. They go negative and then they go positive again.
Oh, dear.
Right. So I don't mean to raise any concerns there. But the issue likely there is that the test just wasn't able to detect a small amount of viral particle. And then the next time, maybe the sample was a little bit better and there was more virus bits left and it was detectable. We don't know what these things mean with regards to an ability to transmit to others. So we're taking the most conservative precautions with regards to recommending isolation after disease, whether proven or suspected. And we're even more careful about that when it comes to healthcare workers and people who are working in settings among vulnerable persons. So a lot to learn yet, but those are some of the new features that this virus is presenting to us.
So Dr. Talbot, just to be clear, having COVID-19 clearly confirmed, you know, recovering from that illness is not a get out of jail free card.
We have criteria to correlate with infectivity. That is, we would advise that a person who's confirmed or suspected with disease remain on isolation for 7 days after first symptom, and also at least 3 days has passed since the onset of some recovery, including lack of fever. So those are the criteria that we are adhering to and believe work well. Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, by that get out of jail free card, and maybe that wasn't well phrased, what I'm trying to ask is, if I had COVID-19, if I recovered, am I good from here on out? Like, I'm not going to get it again, and I'm not going to infect my family.
Oh, yeah, great point. So we believe that when you have disease, when you know, confirmed or not, that you are likely immune. That's the word that's been used by Sheila and others. You likely are not susceptible to getting it again or transmitting it to others. So,
okay.
Yeah,
Sheila. Yeah, no, and there's a lot still to be discovered there for sure. And Sheila, I really appreciate the call and also all the people who wrote in their questions, including Ellen on that one. And Jason Moon, I'm going to throw back to you. I know you have more questions around this topic of like when people can get back out and get back to possibly a little bit of normal life.
I do. Dr. Talbot, if I could just follow up on a couple of things you said there. One is getting back to earlier when you were talking about contact tracing and how obviously, that's been something that public health officials in New Hampshire have been doing since the beginning, and it was arguably more of a focus sort of in those earlier days than it is now. But it does seem now that we're beginning to have the discussion about reopening that contact tracing will again be a really important part of the overall approach here. My question is, how many people do we currently have in public health doing contact tracing, and are there, you know, do we have enough, and are there plans to hire more? We just saw in Massachusetts they just hired, you know, 1,000 new contact tracers to be really aggressive about doing those tracings. Do we have any similar plans here in New Hampshire?
A couple things on that, Jason. I'm surprised to hear you say that it was more of a focus at the beginning, and I want to correct that we have been full court press on this since the beginning. We've not let up on our contact tracing at all. So we do believe we'll need to put more attention to it, you know, that when we decide that it's appropriate, when the governor decides it's appropriate to release some of the suggested social distancing and closures, we will even accelerate that, and probably would need more staff. But I'll leave staffing issues to the administration here.
And I should say the issue of focus. I was speaking more from the public, or perhaps from my own perspective, not in terms of what you folks were doing. But do you have a sense of how many contact tracers are working right now?
Yeah. So if I can jump in.
Sure.
You know, there's multiple lines of work here, if you will. There's people that are doing the investigations and the contact tracing. There's people that are doing the monitoring of people that we know are on isolation and quarantine. You know, and I think in our infectious disease group, you know, as a whole, there's, you know, probably around 70 or so individuals that are actively doing a lot of this work. And there's efforts being made to bring on more staff and more capacity, you know, increasing staffing by, you know, at least 50 to 70%, you know, potentially in the coming days. So this is something that I think all health departments around the country are looking at doing, especially as we see the numbers across the country begin to plateau or peak. And there will be a need for not only increased testing, but, you know, increased testing is really only helpful if we can follow up those tests with the public health contact tracing that is being discussed. So there's a general recognized need to connect that testing with increased ability to do the investigations. And that is occurring in New Hampshire, and that's occurring, you know, in states around the country.
Yeah, and if I could just drill down on that for a second, that 50 to 70% increase in public health workers, contact tracers, that's in the works, that's happening now. How real is that?
Yeah, that's in the works right now. You know, I can't speak to, you know, exact numbers on when exact people will be brought on, but that is something that we have continually monitored and have ongoing efforts to make sure that we are staffed appropriately and have the ability to increase staff if and when it's needed.
Okay. And then, Dr. Chan, maybe I'll turn to you on this one. Earlier, we were the discussion about whether a test is the sort of be-all, end-all for someone's relationship to COVID-19. What about, I think, the sort of big fear that a lot of people might have is false negatives. You know, what do we know anything about the rate at which false negatives are occurring? Someone gets a test for COVID-19, this test says they don't have it, but the test is wrong. Is there a percentage that we know of at this point of tests that are coming back falsely negative?
So anytime you roll out a test, you need to compare it to something. What's the gold standard of diagnosing disease? And right now, you know, from what we know about these tests are that they are very sensitive for picking up replicating, or not even necessarily replicating virus, for picking up virus in the upper respiratory tract. There has been a lot of talk about high false negative rates with this test, and honestly, I have not seen much data to support this. I think a lot of this is coming from anecdotal reports from outbreaks in other countries, clinicians that have seen patients that, you know, in outbreak settings that they're concerned have COVID-19, but people test positive, right? We're getting these same reports here in New Hampshire. But I think it's important to keep in mind that there are many things that cause the same kind of symptoms and clinical picture that COVID-19 can cause. And so there has been this message, this communication going around, you know, that these tests are not sensitive at picking up infection. And we believe that they are. They should be, by the nature of the test, very sensitive at picking up virus in the upper respiratory tract. Certainly no test is 100% perfect, so there's always going to be the possibility that someone could test negative, and still have the infection. But we don't have a lot of evidence that this is occurring commonly.
Well, coming up, a couple more questions from our listeners about quarantine and more questions about when and how and what might be needed before people could start to again emerge from their stay-at-home orders. We'll take a lot more of your questions. Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, the state's two top public health doctors are with us to answer your questions. So Exchange listeners, keep them coming in. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And our guests are state epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan, deputy state epidemiologist Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, who's also an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And helping us out with questions today, too, is NHPR's health reporter Jason Moon. A couple more questions for you, and I'll throw this to you, Dr. Talbot. We have received many questions about grocery products, with listeners asking, should they wipe down every milk carton and cereal box when they get home? Now, we talked to grocery store leaders last week. They said no, but we still continue to get these questions. So, Dr. Talbot, what are you doing when you get home from the grocery store?
I am not wiping everything down.
You're not?
No. We approach this with humility, right? We don't know everything we want to know. We know that there have been some really carefully controlled studies where they take virus and place it under extremely controlled circumstances on different kinds of surfaces and see how long they can recover it. And indeed, as one of our previous question submitters said, it can be hours and even days under these strict laboratory conditions where every feature is controlled. That's not life on planet Earth. That's not what happens on a carton of milk in the grocery store. These are subject to temperature and to handling only by very few people. So we keep stepping back to what we do know about this virus, and that is that we can prevent environmental contamination by adopting the universal masking, this cloth face mask covering. That's what we're doing with that. We're trying to prevent environmental contamination, and that includes groceries.
Well, and a similar question about contamination, Dr. Talbot, came in from Jamila in Portsmouth, who writes, how likely is coronavirus carried on clothing? And we have heard from healthcare workers and grocery workers who tell us they're shedding all their clothes as soon as they get home, immediately putting them in the wash. What about that, Dr. Talbot?
I'm not aware of a single case that's been transmitted by clothing contamination. I think that people are right to be careful with the recognition that there can be virus contaminating environments, especially commonly touched surfaces like doorknobs and handrails and grocery cart handles, et cetera. But I'm just not aware of that as a mechanism of transmission.
All right. And Jason, I'll throw it back to you. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Dr. Chan, just return to the topic of testing yet again. Based on the data that the state has been sharing with the public, for about the past month, we've been averaging about 450 tests a day. For people in New Hampshire, that's commercial labs, that's through the state lab, through Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center's in-house test. What is there a number at which you feel like we need to be getting two tests per day to be more confident in making decisions about reopening? You know, is it 1,000 tests a day? Is it 2,000? Is it 10,000? Is that a number you watch?
Good question. And I think there's a couple questions in that. The ability to or the reopening things, I don't think is dependent on our ability to be doing a certain number of tests, right? The ability to start reopening, I think, is dependent on what the evidence of community transmission shows. So once we have evidence of sustained decreasing community transmission, regardless of like the number of tests that are being performed, then I think there is when there needs to be consideration for opening, you know, slowly and gradually, incrementally opening things in our society.
But just to jump in here, wouldn't your confidence in the fact that it is beginning to taper or slow increase if there was more testing, right? You'd be more confident that the curve is actually going downwards based on a larger sample size, wouldn't you?
Yes. So I think that testing can help inform that, certainly. I didn't mean to imply otherwise. But we also have other data, hospitalization numbers, outbreaks, you know, the number and extent mm-hmm. of outbreaks at facilities. We have community tracking of healthcare and ER emergency room visits for people going in for influenza-like illnesses, right? All of these data points need to be taken into consideration when I think deciding when is an appropriate time to start reopening things. Testing becomes much critically important for trying to move from a community mitigation to a containment standpoint. And so our goal should be I think, and again, this is my own personal perspective on this, isn't necessarily a set number of tests as opposed to really being able to go out and test anybody with COVID-19 symptoms, right? And that is a goal that we're working towards. We want to increase testing capacity now. As we increase testing capacity now, we're going to see an increase in numbers because as we test more, we're going to detect more. But the ultimate, you know, trigger point, if you will, for when to start reopening, I think is going to come down to sort of broader numbers and data on evidence of community transmission and not simply on how many people we can test. We need to be able to test more because that's going to impact how quickly and how rapidly and how confidently we can reopen things. We're working towards that, but there are many different factors involved in this decision about when things can be reopened.
Thanks, Dr. Chan. Dr. Talbot, to you, there are some in New Hampshire who would like to reopen much sooner than perhaps is the general sentiment. Just this past weekend, there was a rally, a demonstration on the State House lawn of, I would say, well over 100 people, you know, calling on the governor and the legislature to remove some of these restrictions and reopen the economy. And you know, along with arguments about sort of individual liberty and constitutional arguments, they also made a public health argument that I would like to get your response to. And the argument was that there are serious negative public health consequences to a recession, that if a lot of people lose their jobs, we have a really high unemployment rate, that will lead to increases in suicide and in substance misuse disorders, and that could ultimately end up doing more harm than the coronavirus pandemic. That was one of the arguments sort of on display on Saturday. How would you respond to that as an epidemiologist?
I think that it's certainly understandable that people are wanting to get back to their routine life and also to recover the economy. This story will be told over months and years, what the risk and cost and benefit have been of the actions taken. I certainly don't want us to lose sight of the fact that the current plateau we're seeing is a result of these efforts. And when they are loosened, it's likely that there can be rebound. So these are extremely complex equations to come to the right cost to our society for these interventions. I'm certainly working toward protecting those who are most vulnerable. So those who are most likely to die from this disease need to be protected, in my opinion.
Well, let's take another call from our listeners. Lots of emails and calls coming in, exchange@nhpr.org or the number 1-800-892-6477. And Chris is in Epping calling in. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi, Laura. Thank you. I've heard a lot about wastewater testing. I heard about it a couple weeks ago, but not much since. There was a company called BioBot out of MIT, which was able to detect COVID-19 in wastewater and also estimate the prevalence of the infection in a community. And with all this talk about securing new swabbing tests and a containment approach, what I'm wondering is, why aren't we hearing more about augmenting that type of testing with wastewater testing and using it as an early detection system?
So, Chris, sort of as a community read, not an individual read, but a community read, how much COVID is there in the wastewater, and what does that tell us about the community? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The articles that I've read have said that it can be used as an early detection system, that you can see what the prevalence is of COVID-19 in the community. And if you see a spike from wastewater testing, what you can then do is isolate that community, quarantine, respond, follow up with traditional testing, and do contact tracing. But it can be used as an early detection system. It seems like it could really augment, the traditional testing, for lack of a better way to say it.
And sure, the person-to-person testing.
That we don't have a lot of... we don't have enough of those types of tests.
That's interesting, Chris. Thank you for calling. And Dr. Chan, I've not heard of this, but we have done earlier shows on just trace amounts of pharmaceuticals showing up in water supplies before they are treated. Have you heard anything about this, Dr. Chan, COVID-19 testing in community wastewater?
Yeah, so Chris is right that there have been, I'm aware of one other place that went out and more in the realm of research, tested wastewater to see if they could find it. And, I think what it means to find virus in wastewater, I'm not sure how that would be actionable from a community or a public health standpoint. I think it's a good question. Can it give us some information? And I think we know that COVID-19 is in our communities and it's widespread, and we expect it to be, if we were to go out and test wastewater, we would expect COVID-19, to be detected. Again, the genetic material to be detected, but it wouldn't necessarily change what we do, right? We're already doing contact tracings and public health investigations. We're already trying to ramp up testing of people that are sick and symptomatic. We're already trying to long-term care facilities. So, you know, I don't think it's something that has, one, been well validated or studied, and two, I don't think it would change what we're doing currently, because we believe COVID-19 is widespread in our communities.
Well, Chris, thank you for the call. And Andy wrote us an email. Can anyone say what will happen when the test results from healthcare facilities come back with positive results? Andy asks, is there a secret population of healthcare workers ready to take over? Andy, excellent question. And Dr. Talbot, I know this is something that, you know, doctors' offices, hospital systems, nursing homes have been worried about, that as more of their workers get sick and have to stay home, who's going to take over?
So there are many strategies emerging for crisis standards of care. So ways to continue to deliver vital health care, even if healthcare workers are disproportionately impacted by this virus or whatever's next. So even now, we are implementing the most careful of strategies to allow certain essential personnel to return to work under controlled circumstances. And we're also exploring strategies to bring healthcare workers back into the health force or early into the health force. So it's something that we've been planning for a very long time, even before COVID-19 showed its ugly face.
Well, and a related question came in from Peggy in Hollis, who says, if a nurse or other healthcare professional comes to New Hampshire from another state to provide relief to staff, does that nurse need to self-quarantine for 14 days before he or she can begin to work at the New Hampshire facility? Are they tested at the New Hampshire facility? This is a great question, too. Peggy, thank you for writing in. And Dr. Talbot, go ahead.
So we're in universal masking in healthcare facilities for the purpose of avoiding shedding for somebody who is before symptoms. And we're also requiring screening at the entrance of every health facility for staff and visitors alike, and patients alike, to make sure that nobody is minimally symptomatic or early in the course of their disease. So there are redundant strategies to prevent introduction of disease into our healthcare facilities.
So that nurse would not have to self-quarantine for 14 days if he or she came to New Hampshire to help out?
No. When there's a need for a healthcare worker in a setting, risk-benefit favors having that person work under very controlled, observed circumstance. So that's right.
Well, last questions for both of you. And again, you've been really generous with your time. We appreciate it. And Dr. Chan, what is the one question that you're getting over and over that regular people, you know, like me, like Jason Moon, who aren't medical experts, just seem to have a hard time understanding? What do you keep hearing, Dr. Chan, again and again from folks?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think there's a lot of, we're still learning about this virus, and so I think understandably there's a lot of questions and concerns and even confusion. The one question that keeps coming up, I think, is similar to the questions that have been asked on this show around when we can reopen and testing. So how testing relates to reopening, and I would repeat again that we want to increase testing capacity as much as possible. Testing will help inform the spread of COVID-19 in our communities. But testing becomes critically important when we start to reopen things back up so that we can respond to clusters of infection that pop up and go more from a mitigation mode, social distancing mode, to containment mode, trying to stamp out infection, if you will, before it can spread. That's where testing becomes critically important. When we can start to reopen things back up, I think, is a question that's still being discussed and debated, not only in New Hampshire, but across the country. And obviously, we want to take a safe but proactive approach to this, and we need to do it based on, data and in being informed by our capacity to undertake these important public health steps of testing and contact tracing.
Well, we really appreciate you being with us today. And again, we had a lot more questions from our listeners. So I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Dr. Chan, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's state epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan. And Dr. Talbot, thank you also for your time.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Talbot. She's also an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, as well as the deputy state epidemiologist. And Jason Moon, it was great having your help. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Always happy to do it, Laura.
That's Jason Moon, NHPR's health reporter. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. And our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.